Welcome to The First Five, a program of the Newseum Institute in Washington, D.C., dedicated to the five freedoms guaranteed by the First Amendment. The First Five is a podcast where we cut through the legal jargon and explain to you exactly how your First Amendment freedoms work and what you can do to protect them. I'm your host, Letha Knott. When we think about freedom of speech, we usually picture someone standing on a soapbox, calling out the government for misconduct, or expressing a controversial opinion, or making a speech about their political beliefs. But the First Amendment doesn't just protect passionate speeches. Sometimes it just protects a single word, like the word you use to describe what you do. Think about it for a second. Are you allowed to use any word you want to describe your job? Can you call yourself an artist, even if you've never been to art school? Yeah, sure, of course you can. And you can call yourself a writer, even if you've never published anything. There are people who call themselves computer programmers who don't necessarily have a degree in computer science, like Mark Zuckerberg, for example. But I'm a lawyer, and believe me, you have to get a law degree to call yourself that. You have to get a degree, and then you have to pass a state bar exam, and then you have to pay your fees, and you have to take a certain number of educational courses each year. You don't really have the right to call yourself a lawyer otherwise. Most states have laws that say you can't hold yourself out to be a medical doctor unless you meet certain requirements, which is honestly pretty reassuring. But what about calling yourself a psychologist?
Our guest today is Mary Lou Seraphine, an Austin attorney and psychologist. Last year, she won an important legal victory in the Fifth Circuit. She represented herself in court, using her skills as an attorney to win her right to call herself a psychologist. Previously, she wasn't able to do that in Texas, even though she had completed a postdoctoral fellowship in psychology at Yale and has taught psychology herself at Yale. She wasn't licensed by the Texas State Board of Examiners of Psychologists, so she was ordered not to refer to herself as a psychologist. And Mary Lou brought a First Amendment challenge, and she won. Mary Lou, thanks for being with us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
So can you tell me a little bit about your background as a lawyer and a psychiatrist, just to start us off?
Yes. And first, let me say the difference between psychology and psychiatry is that psychiatry is a medical field. Psychology is a non-medical field. So,
oh, see, I'm doing it. I'm messing up the words. Yes, a lawyer and a psychologist. Right.
It's easy to do. It's easy to do. So, way back in graduate school, I have a PhD from the School of Education at the University of Florida, which allowed me to do an interdisciplinary PhD across psychology and music and education. My doctoral dissertation was published in Genetic Psychology Monographs, which is genetic psychology is an old-fashioned word for developmental psychology. It has to do with how children grow and learn and understand the world. And after teaching at the University of Texas, actually, I then took a four-year postdoctoral fellowship in psychology at Yale in the psychology department. I taught there while I was there as well. And then I served on the faculty at Vassar College. That would be from about 1983 to 88. And after that, I went to law school, also at Yale, and then practiced law in Los Angeles before returning to Austin, I guess, a little over 10 years ago. So that's kind of a synopsis of where I've been. When I came back to Austin, I began giving small group seminars to people at midlife who had undergone divorce or were otherwise single. And these were weekly three-hour seminars, and they were very helpful for people. They were for both men and women single at midlife. At the time that I gave these, I considered them, and I attempted to draw a distinction between educational seminars and therapeutic ones. And today, I no longer draw that distinction. These were therapy, in my opinion, because they were therapeutic to people and they were intended to help them. So that is a...
And is there
their nature.
Legally, is there often a distinction between whether something is educational or therapeutic in the practice of psychology?
Well, that's a very interesting question. You know, the answer is there used to be a distinction before Seraphine versus Brannaman, and now there isn't. the Fifth Circuit has said the giving of advice and opinions has been going on for a long time, and it is, to quote the Fifth Circuit, a foundation of society that people give advice to one another. The Court of Appeals, this is a federal Court of Appeals, so just one step down from the U.S. Supreme Court, the judges said whether that advice is obtained from an almanac or at the feet of grandparents, it is a foundation of society that we are able to do that. Now, is it illegal under, quote, in psychology? The answer to that is that nearly all the states now have laws defining psychology, and that those definitions, in my view, are so broad, yes, they include just about everything. Just about any conversation of a helping nature that you could have with a person. And they want to claim for professional psychology, which is sometimes called organized psychology. I think that use of the term organized psychology approximates our use of it when we think of organized crime. But it's organized psychology, and it defines itself in a very broad way. As Dr. Brannaman said in his testimony in the case, it could include, he was not able to distinguish between psychology and Weight Watchers or golf coaching for either children or adults. Smoking cessation programs, wasn't able to determine whether those were or were not under the rubric of psychology.
Right, because it's a very broad profession, and I can see the speech issue right there, which is that if the state says you cannot call yourself a psychologist unless you have met these certain requirements, and when the practice of psychology is just so broad and can mean a lot of different things. I think there's a distinction between that and being a medical doctor where there's certain uniform standards. Isn't that right?
Well, yes. And first of all, remember, medical doctors can perform brain surgery. They can prescribe drugs that greatly affect the body. And psychologists do nothing more than talk. They don't touch the body. They don't cut the hair. They don't shave the face. Psychologists talk, and my view is that, and the theory of my case was that, since psychologists don't do anything except talk, we are free to talk to whomever we want and to seek advice from whomever we want, whether it's paid or not, and I, as a person, am entitled to offer my advice and opinions about marriage, life, child rearing, anyone who's willing to listen to me about it, and charge money if the person is willing to do so.
So one thing that I wanted to cover was how this case began for you. I know the whole thing started when you were running for the Texas Senate. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I was running for Texas Senate, and my bio on SeraphineForSenate.com opened with the sentence, Mary Lou Seraphine is an Austin attorney and psychologist. I received then a cease and desist order from the Texas State Board of Examiners of Psychologists, so that I'll just call them the Psychology Board, and that was followed up by effectively a threat of prosecution by the Attorney General's office, although they offered to sit down and chat with me about it. I had no doubt at the time that they would try to get me to sign a document in which I would agree to control my speech in the ways that they wanted to, and then we would part ways and everybody would be happy. I wasn't happy about that at all, of course, and I told the lawyer for the Board of Psychology, this is unconstitutional. Now, let me say what I was thinking at the time. What I was thinking at the time is, we live in the United States of America. We're entitled to call ourselves whatever we want. We're not entitled to defraud people, but we can call ourselves a unicorn if we want to. That was my thinking. And in addition, as to the small group seminars that I had been giving, which at that by that time I was no longer giving because I was running for office, we're also entitled to do what I and my groups were doing at that time, which is meeting on private property and talking about our problems, talking about our experiences, sharing our experiences. I am absolutely certain the First Amendment entitles us to meet on private property in small groups to discuss whatever we want.
Right. You are assembling. And I think so. It wasn't just that they didn't want you to call yourself a psychologist. They also, it's not that you were holding those small groups at the time, but if you had been, they would have asked you to cease that, or would you just have had to cease calling it psychology?
The cease and desist order forbade both.
Okay.
That is to say, it forbade use of the word psychologist and also, by the way, psychology or psychological if they refer to oneself or to services that one offers. And under the definition of the statute, which I said was very, very broad, it also ordered me to not practice psychology in Texas.
So don't give any mental health advice to anybody, basically, that's what it means?
Yes.
Wow, that is broad.
Yes.
So it sounds like you are generally not in favor of the state licensing requirements or for different professions, but do you think that, like, are there exceptions, like, say, for doctors, or, hey, for our own profession, for lawyers? What do you think of that?
Well, let me address doctors first, because it came up at the Supreme Court during during oral arguments in this great case called North Carolina Dental Association. But one of the Supreme Court justices said, well, isn't it true that if I were going to have brain surgery or neurosurgery, I would want to be certain that the doctor was licensed, wouldn't I? And he addressed this to the lawyer that was representing one side or the other. I don't even remember. The correct answer to that question is this. Neurosurgeons are not licensed as neurosurgeons. Each state licenses MDs. They could be psychiatrists who are eligible to distribute drugs if they want to. They can be brain surgeons. They can be foot or leg surgeons. They could be doctors who do nothing more than read x-rays. The answer is the real regulation of doctors is entirely private. It's not government. The boards of OBGYN, the board of I don't remember if it's called can't be called neurology anymore, but the surgical boards, all of those boards are entirely private organizations. They are giving a certification, not a license. They don't have the power to stop anybody else from practicing obstetrics and gynecology. And it's a purely private system. Meanwhile, the hospitals and insurance companies, they can choose, and they're entirely able to choose, and I support this, they can choose not to deal with any doctors unless they are certified by the proper board that the doctor is practicing in.
As I mentioned at the start of this episode, Mary Lou won her case. The Fifth Circuit found in her favor and said that she did have the right to call herself a psychologist. But what's interesting is, in that opinion, they delved into her reasons for using that word, psychologist. The court found it significant that Mary Lou wasn't calling herself a psychologist in ads for her services or communications with clients or prospective clients. She was calling herself a psychologist on her political campaign website to inform voters about her background. And that's important because courts often put speech into different categories when they're analyzing whether it's protected or not. Political speech is the most protected type of speech. Commercial speech, speech you make to sell someone a service or a product, gets less protection because courts see the government as having an interest in protecting customers from manipulation or exploitation. A number of courts, but not all of them, have recognized professional speech as another speech category. Here's an example of how that works. Let's say I'm a psychic. If I go out into the world, into some public space, and tell everyone that I have psychic powers and that the world will end in 9 days, I'm just voicing my opinion. I'm just sharing my thoughts with the public, and that speech is protected, and the government can't tell me to stop just because I'm not a licensed psychic. But if I'm a psychic and I'm meeting with a paying client in a private setting, and I'm telling her that her world is going to end in 9 days, that could be considered professional speech. And some courts say that the government has more power to regulate that kind of speech. In this case, they might require me to have a psychic's license. The Fifth Circuit found that Serafine's speech on her campaign website was not professional or commercial speech. It was political speech of the highest form, a candidate seeking election to public office. But Mary Lou's not a huge fan of the concept of putting speech into categories in the first place.
I want to say a word about professional speech. It's not what the Fifth Circuit did say about so-called professional speech, is that the Supreme Court of the United States has never approved of the idea. And I don't approve of it either. Whatever professional speech is, no one knows. Is professional speech when you have a license or when you don't have a license? If you are a political consultant, and none of them are licensed because there isn't such a thing, and you're advising a candidate for money, are you engaging professionally? I think so. And I believe the federal courts, and I believe if it ultimately came to the Supreme Court, the courts would not ratify a distinction between professional speech and any other kind of speech, including political speech, by the way, which happens to be the topic that I was, the arena in which I was engaged. But we should think about it this way. What if we take speech and we divide it up into all different types, commercial speech, professional speech, political speech, and now we have 3 or 4 or 5 different types of speech. We could have family speech, and we could have child-rearing speech, and spousal speak, and all kinds of things. And then what if the states start passing laws that you can engage in some types but not others? We will eventually come to the same violations of the First Amendment that we otherwise have, which is the state will be in charge of describing what it is that we're doing, that is, we're engaging in, let's call it family speech, and they'll say you can't engage in it, or you can only engage in it if the child is your biological child, but you can't engage in it if it's a niece or a nephew or a neighbor kid. It'll be.
I see the dystopian novel now, definitely. If you think of speech in categories like that, I mean, you're right. It's especially when it makes me think about when you were meeting with those people who had just gotten divorced, and that, you know, at what point is that like the practice of psychology by the state's definition, and at what point is it a group of people meeting to talk out their problems and possibly paying somebody for facilitating? You know, it's just, you're always going to have that, I think, when it comes to professional speech and what's non-professional or non-commercial speech. There's the line can be kind of fuzzy there.
Yes, absolutely. The line is fuzzy, and even if we had rules to divide up the categories very neatly, what we don't want is for the government to be making the decisions about what something is. There's more information about the case the trial transcripts and other things at mlserafine.com. That's the website that is exclusively devoted to this case, mlserafine.com.
I've checked it out. It's a great resource. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today for another episode of The First Five, a production of the Newseum Institute, located at the Newseum in the heart of Washington, D.C. The Newseum, where there's more to every story. For more information about the Newseum Institute, go to museuminstitute.org.